He's the adjunct professor of public relations at the Boston University School of Public Communication, and he's editor of PR Reporter, an international professional newsletter, and Channels, a nonprofit newsletter. I could go on for the rest of the page here, but I think you'll discover more about who Patrick Jackson is.
As you just heard, I from consorting with the devil. It's a kind of a substitute for willpower. When you boil it all down, I've decided after 30 years of public relations practice that the real essence of what public relations professionals do is summed up in some terms that we have not been using. It seems to me that what we do is perception management. We really have as our goal not the imparting of information, not even just building relationships, but that somehow we have got to find a way to deal with people's perceptions of our institutions, and that means helping people themselves, both inside the institution and outside, deal with their perceptions of themselves, of their world, and then, of course, of the place of the institution within that world. Now, you may say, gosh, you know, what do we have to do all that for? Well, the reason that I have concluded, at least, my colleagues and I, that this is what we must do is because we have not found any other way to successfully achieve the goals that are set for us by our institutions. To take a simplistic viewpoint that public relations activities are simply to send out some information and leave it in people's hands to act upon it or not to act upon it as they will is indeed a cop-out. It's to drop out of the situation and say, well, we told them. We gave them all the information. If they didn't want to do anything about it, it's up to them. Of course it's up to them. That's the way, fortunately, in democratic societies, that the system works. People, once they know the situation, are free to do or not to do as they please. But there's a problem. And that is that information itself, information alone, is not enough for the human animal to decide whether or not he or she wants to do something or not to do something. So therefore, those of us who are involved in public relationships in any way, again, this is my perception, but those of us who are involved have got to start thinking in terms of the perceptions of all of those people out there and all of us in here, inside the organization, and approach it from that point of view. Now, of course, the first step, therefore, in perception management is to find out what the perceptions are out there and in there about your institution. Well, this morning, I guess I ought to do similarly in the time that we have together. I don't have time to do the formal research that I would do for a client to find out what your perceptions are, but I would imagine right off there are at least a couple of things that I can be fairly certain are on your mind. First, some of you are probably wondering what this guy from New Hampshire could possibly know about Canada. So let me assure you that we have had clients in Canada since 1956. I had an office in Canada for a number of years, and think we know a little something about the Canadian marketplace. In fact, two of the major medical institutions in your country, I would like to say in our country, because I really feel a part of all of North America, but we have these silly boundaries, you know, have been clients of ours for some time. So I think I at least have a hint of what your problems are. You probably also have a perception that somebody that is a consultant, as I am, who, you know, kind of flits in and says, why don't you do this, and then flits out to ask somebody else why they don't do this, you may be wondering how someone like that could really understand your day-to-day needs. Well, in response to that, let me simply say that for a number of years, we have represented hospitals all across the continent, all the way from a tiny little hospital up in northern Maine that is owned by the city, and everybody in the hospital family wishes they weren't, and so they would like us to help them become not for-profit, but at least private, in the sense of not having to talk to the city council every other week about, you know, how many sterilizers they ought to have and that kind of important stuff, all the way to two of the major teaching units and medical research centers in the United States. Now, this doesn't mean, however, that I have the same problems that those of you who are practicing public relations in institutions, because it is true, every day you have got to do it on the spot. And I am able to come along and get an overview of what you do, and then I don't have to stick around to run the typewriter or consult with the management or go out and face the public. I would, however, like to translate this experience of mine, which differs from yours in that I get to see a lot of institutions over a relatively short period of time, into what I believe is really a generic statement about the whole status of public relations, public relationships, maybe society in general. First of all, you'll be interested in knowing, I think, that your particular problems, you may already know this, but your particular problems are no different than those of hospitals that I work with in New Mexico, New Jersey, Florida. The problems are exactly the same. The problems are, where is the money going to come from? Is the public going to accept, as they have in the past, medical technology? Or are they going to believe all those TV soap operas where somebody is run over by a truck in one scene and is up, you know, bouncing around, dancing in the next? By the way, there's a lot of evidence, as you probably know, that people do believe that, and they don't know why it takes so long or is costly to get cures for minor little things that years ago they never would have survived. And then there's that other problem, which may be the bigger problem, and that is, how will those of us who are concerned with the offering of healthcare services organize ourselves to really deliver those services? Maybe another way of phrasing that is, will we organize ourselves, or will our own lack of an organizational entity, an organizational unity, end up being a real barrier between us and the publics that we're supposed to deal with out there? My newsletter, PR Reporter, does an annual survey of practitioners across North America. And some of the comments from hospital people this last year, who are our readers, I think will sound familiar to you. Asked to identify the major issues, 29% of them said cost containment. Another 10% of them said budgeting and funding cutbacks. And another 14% of them talked about some kind of relationship with the government, whether it was a funding relationship or some different relationship. So I think you can see the point. However, let me carry it just one step further. You today could be, on this topic, a group of bankers, manufacturers, university officials, in the public schools. You could, in fact, be in religious organizations. You could be in almost any sector in our society, because not only do hospitals everywhere have the same challenges and opportunities, but in fact, every institution in North American society today is dealing with exactly the same problems you are. And that's the first point I want to try to persuade you of, to maybe help shape our mutual perceptions a little before I really dig into the topic. Can we agree among us that what I've said is essentially correct? Would you agree with that statement, that first of all, hospitals everywhere have similar problems. But more importantly, that the situation of health care is not an awful lot different than the situation of almost every other institution. Because if we have some disagreements on that, if indeed some of us are falling into the trap of thinking that, gosh, our field is different, that we are unique, if we are falling into that trap, then my perception is that that perception of ours is the problem. I simply cannot find any evidence in dealing with all kinds of institutions across the social spectrum that the difficulties faced by one institution today are different than any other. Oh, you may say that there are some institutions that don't have quite the funding problems you do, but believe me, every institution today has funding problems. Every institution. You may say, well, gosh, we have this terrible shortage of doctors in some locations and nurses in others, of volunteers in others, and some institutions don't even need that kind of personnel. Well, that's true, but they certainly have their counterparts of that kind of personnel, and in my experience, it doesn't make an awful lot of difference what sector of the economy, what social sector you're in today. The problems and opportunities are the same. Now, the reason that I think that's a key point, pardon me, this is for taping this session and I'm not able to quite get it on here because it weighs a ton. Well, one button more or less on my shirt won't matter. The reason that I'm emphasizing this point is because it is the essence of the marketing philosophy. The marketing philosophy, carried to its logical conclusion, simply postulates that every idea, every product, every service, and every institution within a society are competing one with another. But you know, so many of our institutions have not agreed to that. We represent a lot of colleges and universities. And oh my goodness, so many of them really believe that God ordained that they would get so much dough every year, and you know, so many students, and they could spend it pretty much any way they wanted, because after all, they know more than others about some subjects. And therefore, life would always be like that. And I'm overemphasizing a bit, but if any of you have spent any time on campus, you'll know that I'm not overemphasizing by much. The thought that a family which needs medical care or a new car may indeed not be able to participate in higher education the way they would if they didn't need those other products, those other services, has not crossed the minds of many university people. And I am sorry to say that I find many folks in healthcare who believe that because, after all, it's health, it's sickness, or it used to be sickness, that people who need it are going to sacrifice almost everything to come to it. Well, you all know the statistics. People aren't. They will indeed not deal with wellness. They will put it off until it is indeed illness. And then it becomes a devastating thing for everybody. Or the patient may not survive, and so your statistics are really not helped much. In fact, I don't know of any evidence, maybe some of you do, that all of our institutions are not competing one with another. Now, if we can accept that premise, it sure makes talking about marketing in a healthcare setting a lot simpler, because we no longer think of ourselves as this unique service, this caring service to mankind. I think we all ought to continue to use phrases like that, caring service to mankind, but I don't know if any of you do any, I hope you do a lot, but I don't know if any of you do any attitude surveys toward healthcare institutions the way we do in our Dudley Research subsidiary. But I think the way we use the word caring and the way many of our consumers use the word caring have slightly different meanings. In fact, I'm sorry to say that we don't find that word used as much as we would like among the consumers. But if we can agree that health care indeed in society is now not only in a competitive field in its own arena, but is also competing with every other institution in society, then let's talk about marketing. And if you're sitting out there with some reserve about all of this, be my guest. I will try to convince you as we go along. I have a hunch maybe the workplace back home has already convinced you. But now it's my turn. I've tried to deal with some of your perceptions about me. Let me give you some of my perceptions about you, but first let me do a little research. All good public relations begins with research, and I don't want to violate that tenet. How many of you here are indeed public relations professionals? You consider yourself to be professional practitioners working full-time on a daily basis in some area of public relations. Let me see your hands. Okay, how many of you are administrators, management personnel of some kind or another, not directly involved with public relations? Okay, how many of you are management personnel but who find you are stuck with the public relations function? Yeah. I see those unhappy faces when I ask that question. How many of you are in that category that we generally term other? How many others are there? Okay, I assume that you are members of boards of trustees or some other category that I probably wouldn't understand if you told me about it. Fundraising, well, I consider that's public relations at one of its toughest points. And we're going to talk about fundraising a little bit. My perception of those of you here who are public relations practitioners, and therefore my perception of a decision that has been made by those of you here who are managers, is something like this. That in healthcare generally, and in Canada specifically, we have generally entrusted public relations to talk to those awful people from the media, because God knows we managers don't want to talk to them anyway. We have entrusted them to put out publications because it's important to communicate the information, but, you know, it's something that we can let be done off somewhere in a corner. We sometimes, as practitioners, are a little bit involved in internal relationships beyond just passing out information. And occasionally we get to do some counseling with the highest levels of the institution. Now, I hope there are those of you here who say, you know, Jackson is full of beans. I am sitting up there in the top management team at my institution, and what I have to say is considered to be sound and is included invariably in the thinking that precedes the decision. I hope a lot of you are sitting there saying that, but I can see from your faces that you are in the small minority. Well, I think to those of you who are practitioners, I would say that's our fault, yours and mine, who are public relations professionals. And to those of you who are managers, I would urge that you take another look at what the public relations function really is, and hope that we can get an understanding that public relations is far more than just information or publicity, a phrase we too often use, and that indeed it may be the essence of your prospering and surviving in the coming years. And I hope to show you why I think so. Let's deal now with one other kind of perception. The topic today is marketing, and whether it's a four-letter word. Well, let's just take the first part. I trust there isn't anybody in this room that hasn't been involved with the topic in one way or another. And so let me ask you to sharpen your own perceptions, to just write down, I trust you all have a handy sheet of paper or can steal one from your neighbor, to just write down what you feel marketing is. What does marketing mean to you? Take a couple of minutes to do that. It's well worth it so that we can have some comparison of where you're coming from and what my experience is showing me, and see if there's an area that some of us, maybe me, maybe some of you, need to adjust our perceptions of what marketing really is, what it means to you. I see some of you jotting something down right away, and others of you a little more puzzled by that. Well, keep what you've written in front of you, and let's see if that's where we all end up at the end of the morning. I have a hunch it won't be, and let me tell you why. There is an institution called the American Marketing Association, which operates in the United States and Canada, and you'll be interested to know that they do not have a definition of marketing because they're not quite exactly sure what it is. They have some hunches about it, and being an association of people involved in marketing, naturally they would like it to take over the world, and so they offer courses in just about everything. One of the courses that they offer is called Marketing Communications, and it says that they will teach you in this course all about advertising, PR, sales promotion, and packaging. I guess that differs a little from my view of marketing, as you'll see in a minute, but I just want to establish the point that the definition of marketing is, I think, one of the reasons it's a four-letter word in the minds of some, and I'll deal with that in a minute. Hospital public relations, which many of you probably read, put out by the American Society for Hospital Public Relations, an affiliate of the American Hospital Association, ran an article last year on marketing in the hospital setting, and indeed what they concluded was that public relations' role in marketing was something akin to sending out the messages, kind of like Western Union. You know, after all the decisions have been made, you call up public relations and you say, we have this message we'd like you to deliver to these people, and would you please run off and deliver this message? And the role of the public relations practitioner was pretty well assigned to that category. In fact, this particular author took many of the traditional functions of public relations, such as dealing with internal audiences, and assigned them to somebody else. We ran an article about that in our newsletter and got a lot of letters. Surprisingly, a lot of letters saying, of course, you know that isn't right, that public relations in hospitals and elsewhere does a lot more than that. But a few practitioners writing and saying, well, yeah, that sounds about like what they let me do here. That was a bit disturbing. I notice in your own publication, however, in your recent issue on marketing, some statements which kind of sum up the state of the situation, if you will. In this issue, which I guess you all have read, those of you who are not members may have picked one up out at the booth, a prominent person in the province is quoted as saying that first, marketing is the identification of a target population and the range of products or services it needs or should need. They don't know they need them. We will tell them that they need them. And secondly, marketing is the design of an approach to convince the target population to use those products or services. Well, I guess that's certainly one that is often cited. More interesting, perhaps, was that individual's assessment of the marketing situation, particularly in healthcare. What he said was that the missing ingredient has been adequate input from the communities or catchment areas the hospital or healthcare institution is designed to serve. In short, we haven't been listening enough to the people out there. Another individual says that, in its purest sense, marketing is a business function with business objectives, such as more efficient operations, for example. We should talk, perhaps, about how marketing can deal with more efficient operations. It is not public relations, he says, advertising, consumer research, sales, or price, but it's a combination of all of these factors. In short, public relations, again, being assigned to a kind of a very specific, apparently message-carrying role. Let's talk just for a minute, then, about a definition that is a workable definition of marketing for a public relations setting in a healthcare institution. Peter Drucker, whose management books I assume many of you have read, are certainly published in the millions, and he's quoted all over the place, claims, I think with a great deal of evidence, that the problem, not just in hospitals and universities and in the public sector, but that the problem in North American businesses, North American corporations, has been a failure to properly define marketing. Because we have allowed marketing to become this big umbrella term, says Peter, with sales and public relations and advertising and just about everything else tucked under it, as if marketing were the be-all and end-all, we have lost the original meaning. And Drucker makes no less a claim that in the case of the auto industry, for example, that it was the loss of this original meaning of marketing that has put that industry into its present dire straits. And here's why. According to Drucker, he says, true marketing starts out with the consumer. It is totally consumer-oriented. It's the needs and values and demographics of that consumer. So marketing, therefore, does not ask, what do we want to sell? Instead, it asks, what does the consumer want to buy? Now, that may sound like just playing with words, but I suggest to you that that is a revolutionary difference from the way most of us are approaching marketing today. That most of us have been lured by this umbrella term, and everything now becomes marketing. I hope to persuade you at least to reconsider that definition if it's the one you're using. Because as Drucker points out, marketing does not say, this is what our product or service does for you. It says, these are the satisfactions you are probably looking for. This is how our product or service is geared to your values. Notice that, values and needs. Too much of the total marketing umbrella is devoted strictly to people's needs, or as the other person I quoted said, what they need or what they should need. Instead, says Drucker, true marketing, which is really public participation in decision making, asks first, what are the needs and values of the consumer? Now, this therefore paints a complete difference between marketing, which is finding out those needs and values, and letting that force, that public force, be the shaper of the institution's services, of the institution's organizational structure, of the institution's locations and outreach, as opposed to sales, which says, look, I mean, this is what we make, and we're going to sell it to you. Now, let's look at the automotive industry, which Drucker uses as his prime example, and see if he's right. The North American automotive industry has been told for at least 20 years that consumers up here wanted cars that gave better gas mileage, that didn't break down on a once monthly schedule, that indeed had some quality to them, and that in general fit the description of cars that happen to now be made by somebody else, primarily Japanese. Now, Yoshiro Honda says that we do not design our cars. He says our customers design our cars. And then he can paint for you a process of exactly how that is true, of how his customers design his automobiles. And the result, I think, is obvious. The American industry has been in the position of saying, look, damn it, these are the cars we make, now you buy one, and we're going to throw all of this promotional material and these flossy television commercials and everything else we can think of to persuade you to buy one. And not only that, we're going to build in planned obsolescence to force you to buy one every 4 or 5 years. And we're going to make a few bucks in the meantime because they're going to break down regularly, and our dealers, after all, have to make money in the service department. And so that is going to be our relationship with you. And of course, now we expect you to love us all this time. On the other hand, the marketing approach, as adopted by the Japanese, was simply to go around the world and say, hey, what kind of a car would you like to have? What's your lifestyle? What do you value? What are your real needs? And how could we produce a car that will meet them? And the results are in the sales figures. But, and this is what I really want to concentrate on secondly today, notice the reflection of that marketing philosophy backward into the institution. If indeed a management group, a small group of people, is going to make a decision about a product or service and then mount a campaign to go out and sell them against all odds, notice the kind of structure inside an organization that that necessitates. It necessitates kind of a non-participative management structure, doesn't it? And if you look at, say, just to use this example, I don't want to pick on American automobiles. I feel so badly for them that when I needed a new car last year, I bought one. You can see me later about whether I'm sorry now, but anyway, if you look at that organization, traditionally it has been hierarchical, it has been non-participative. I mean, what example do workplace engineers use when they talk about disaffection on the job? What's the first example always? Well, it's the automotive assembly line, isn't it? So notice how the way that industry dealt with its publics is reflected inward into the institution. Because we have no value for the opinions of the customers, all we want them to do is write us checks. That's our relationship with them. We translate that inside so that our opinion of our workers is, hey, look, we'll tell you what to do. Don't think. Just do the job and everything will be hunky-dory. I don't know if any of you have ever been to some of the larger automobile factories. We do a lot of work in our firm in quality of work life and worker morale and so forth. And the extent to which disaffection in an industry can occur is immense. And I'm painting this picture for you because I have heard rumors that some healthcare institutions are also run in a somewhat hierarchical way and that maybe they don't always listen to the people out there. But one of the fun games, if you work on the assembly line at one of the plants that we deal with, goes like this, that the job is so boring and your mind is so totally turned off by design that here's the game we play in the morning before lunch. The chassis comes down the assembly line and my job is to put in two screws here and your job is to put a little metal piece on there, right? Okay, now, to see who is going to buy the beer for lunch, this is what we do. As the chassis comes down the line, I plug in my two screws as fast as I can, step over one, leap up through the door opening. The doors haven't been put on yet, you see. Leap up through the door opening, run over there and touch that fire extinguisher, zip over to the Coke machine, and get back before the next one comes along. And you do the same thing. And whichever one of us has the most misses, meaning the next chassis gets past us, buys beer for lunch. It's a great game. You know, they have these people on catwalks up there that are supposed to observe all this and see that it doesn't happen. And they're so bored walking around playing police all day that we discovered in this plant that we observed that a lot of them were the scorekeepers and the referees. They would say, hey, you didn't touch the Coke machine. Now, that's hyperbole, isn't it? It isn't. That's actually happening every day. When you get home, you might check to see that all the screws are in your automobile, but that's happening every day, and hopefully something like that could never happen in healthcare. But I hope that it makes memorable the point I'm trying to make. The mindset an institution has about the people it serves will inevitably, therefore, set the view of the people in the institution and become the total mindset, the total world perception of the whole institution. So now consider the difference as to whether or not your institution has a marketing philosophy which says we exist to serve those folks out there. We are truly a caring institution. And therefore, we are going to pay great attention to their opinions. In fact, we're going to go out of our way to do continuous research and studies and find out what their opinions are. And we also know that we have to have similar caring about the people who constitute the organization. Or the sales approach, which says, look, we've already got it designed, and now we need to sell it. And so these are the constraints on those of us within the organization to just get out there and sell it. The difference between marketing and sales, those two key words, it seems to me, are the basis of this whole discussion of whether marketing is a four-letter word. Given the description that I have just offered you, which, by the way, if you want evidence, I can give you the usual 400 citations. Given that description of marketing, it seems to me that there's really no way that that could be a four-letter word, that that could be a negative concept in any institution. However, if you look at things from the point of view of sales, of selling something, then yes, marketing is a four-letter word. In fact, sales only misses by one anyhow. Now, this is not to say that there's anything wrong with selling, because once you have listened to the public, clearly there's a need to let them know what you've got to offer and to persuade them, perhaps, that they should get it from you rather than someone else. But notice the difference now. Notice the shift between having to resort to tricks like unnecessary operations or planned obsolescence or unnecessarily long hospital stays, short of having to resort to those kind of tricks to make sales. The sales entity now shifts to telling what our services are, how they might benefit you, what you should know as a healthcare consumer in order to be an educated customer of our institution, and why our institution can do whatever it is you want better, perhaps, for you than a competing institution. I suggest to you this is far more than hair splitting, that indeed it's the whole basis. However, let's just take this a step further. If marketing is indeed, as I've described it, public participation, it is consumer oriented, then clearly this means that marketing has to involve the public in the decision-making process inside the institution. Now, that doesn't mean you have to have a consumer panel and they're all going to sit there and veto your new ideas. But it certainly does mean there's got to be continuing research. Those are the two other key words, it seems to me, in this process. There's got to be continuing research, and there's got to be one other ingredient, and that other ingredient, which is a new ingredient in what we've been talking about, is relationships. Now that's, to me, the key, and here's why. Anybody can do research or hire it done. It's not hard to find out the values and needs of your consumers. In fact, if you're working in a healthcare setting in Canada, all you have to do is go to the library of existing studies by the hundreds, by the government, by institutions, by private research firms, to find out how people feel about various healthcare topics And you've already, therefore, got some kind of a provincial or regional or national sample to start from, just by doing library research. All we have to do locally, in most instances, is to ask similar questions or to find out whether the local publics share the view of national publics. And by the way, don't ever make the mistake that your community will share the views of a national public. A number of studies have been done in the past few years to ask whether there is such a thing as a national attitude or a national opinion. And each of them has made this conclusion. If you take a subject and you reduce it down to a sort of a meaningless essence, yes. In other words, you talk about inflation, you bet. National consensus. See? Talk about unemployment, you bet. National consensus. But now back up a little bit and get into the details, and you'll find it's totally different. Some people's economic fears in the eastern part of the country, for example, will be in a totally different sphere of the economy than people's economic fears in the western part of the country.